Thank you. My name is Tom, and I am an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Bill Hatzman for asking me to share my experience, strength, and hope tonight. And I'd like to preface my statements by saying that whatever I share tonight happens to be my experience in my recovery along the journey that I've taken to get here tonight. I know that there are a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous and in Narcotics Anonymous that wrestle with the singleness of purpose, and I just want to preface my share by saying that I grew up in the 70s, and part of my story evolved around my use of drugs and alcohol, and I may inadvertently or overtly share different experiences through that process of what happened, what it was like, and what it's like today. So I would ask for your patience and tolerance, and with that I'll begin. I was born and I grew up in the San Joaquin Valley my whole life. I grew up in an agricultural background. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you are aware, but Burl is a city in the central San Joaquin Valley, and it consists of a post office and a bar during the time I grew up. It was a small west side community that had an elementary school, a bar, and a post office. And during the late 60s and, the late 50s and the early 60s, that happened to be where I, a twin brother, and two older brothers grew up. My father happened to be a fairly large farmer in the west side area. Ended up partnering with another very prominent farmer out of Tulare, California. And over the course of my early life, teenage life, and young adult life, I was privileged to be a part of an agricultural boom that thrust me into the reality and the fantasy of all the things that contributed to my alcoholism. I say that because if you're an alcoholic like me, tomorrow always looks better than today. And I grew up in a household with two wonderful parents, a father that basically worked 6 and 7 days a week to provide for his family. I had a mother that was a stay-at-home mom who saw her responsibility to raise 4 sons in Burl. We were an hour or 45 minutes away from the nearest community, and in some cases maybe 15 minutes from the nearest paved road during that time. Life was simple. Life was Mayberry RFD, and all I did was grow up in a very loving, large extended family between my mom's family and my dad's family, and life was very simple. All up until the time I got to high school. We made a move and moved from Burl into the next thriving metropolis, which was a town called Riverdale. My graduating class had 77 students, but to me, that was comparable to Manhattan or Los Angeles as opposed to Burl. When I began integrating in elementary school and high school, all of a sudden I started becoming a part of groups of people other than my twin brother, other than my two older brothers. And it was a good transition, but it was different. Like I said before, I had a father that was working long hours and continuously, so I didn't necessarily have the kind of father that was around to play catch with, to be a part of my life as I grew up. So I admired what he did, and I wanted to be just like him. What I do remember in my adolescent years were what it was like when I wanted to go spend time with my father and he was unavailable. I remember what that felt like when I'd get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and get dressed and stand by the door hoping that I could spend some time with my father. And I remember what it felt like when my father told me, no, you can't go. And I remember what that feeling felt like, and I did not understand at 8, 9, or 10 years that he didn't tell me I couldn't go because he didn't want me to go. He told me I couldn't go because it wasn't appropriate for an 8 or a 9-year-old child son to be gone for 12 or 13 hours, and he had things to do. But I remember that feeling, and that was some of the first rejection that I can recall, and not being able to understand what was the matter with me. That became an emotion that repeated itself every time I encountered rejection as I got older and older and older. By the time I was a sophomore in high school, about 1975, 1976, the marijuana thing, the riding around in a car with 5 of your buddies and a 12-pack of beer in the trunk was a big thing. The more harsher drugs were not that prevalent. We knew about it, but I would say that in Riverdale, my exposure was 80% alcohol and maybe 20% marijuana. What I recall the first time I drank is I drank and I got sick and I puked. And it wasn't a lot of beer. I was 16 years old. I had gotten my driver's license about a week before. And in my mind, part of being a man was being able to go get a 6-pack of beer and driving in your car and drinking beer. I drank about 3/4 of a beer. It was hot. Started to feel bad and got sick. That was my first experience. My second experience with drinking with 4 or 5 of my peers was if I could drink and not get sick, I felt a part of something. Unfortunately, my tolerance to alcohol was not very good. And what typically happened is I was the first person in the group of 5 guys to get sick. And when I got sick, the other 4 guys in the car made fun of me and started to imply that I was less of a man, couldn't hold my alcohol, and all of the things that made me feel different, made me feel rejected, made me feel not a part of all I wanted to see. Sometime around my junior year in high school, someone handed me a marijuana cigarette and said, try this. What I found out was that I could smoke marijuana and not get sick. So what I did for the next couple of years is I smoked marijuana, but I held a beer. I wanted to make sure that I was observed and I was involved in my peer group drinking. But I didn't want to get sick and I didn't want to be less than. So I changed my substance to primarily marijuana and alcohol so that I could be a part of. What happened over the next couple of years is as I started to smoke marijuana, I started to get the side effects of marijuana, which was dry mouth, drowsiness. So then as that side effect kicked in, then I started to drink a little bit more. When I started to drink more with the use of marijuana, I noticed that I started getting tired. I did not want to get sick. And then about 1977, I was introduced to a substance called cocaine. And what I found out for me was that if I could find the perfect combination of cocaine and marijuana and alcohol, I could drink like those people that I saw that I wanted to drink like. I could use marijuana like those people that I saw use marijuana, and I could also use cocaine like those people that I saw use cocaine. During this period of time, cocaine was a status symbol. I was out of high school. I was involved in the day-to-day operations of my father's business that was rapidly, rapidly expanding. And what I mean by that is that at 8, 9, 10 years of age, my experience in an agricultural background was being out in the field, actively involved in tilling the soil and producing crops. By the time I was a senior in high school, My dad's organization had expanded to about 130,000 acres in California, 50,000 acres in Texas, 1 million acres in Australia, a series of jets, a series of helicopters, and the whole environment of agriculture had changed for me. I no longer saw my role in my father's business as tilling soil. I saw my role in my father's business snorting cocaine, drinking and smoking marijuana in a jet airplane. And that was the transition that I decided to make for myself at 20, 21 years of age. And, that is where the insanity of alcoholism starts to kick in, because as I continued to pursue that career, I started to believe that it was real, and things started to change. By the time I was about 21 years of age, I was in Santa Maria. I had moved to Santa Maria. I was actively involved in the development of a very large wine grape operation, and I decided, under the influence of everything, that it was time to get married. And while actively drinking and using, I picked a waitress in a restaurant that I used to have breakfast on Sunday mornings and decided that this person would be a perfect wife for me. And within about a 60-day period, a courtship began. She became pregnant. And from my values, from my agricultural background, I decided that the right thing to do was to get married. So I was 21 years old, actively drinking, married to a 17-year-old girl, and the father of one son. I was immature, I was incoherent, and I was on free flight from reality. I knew what I was supposed to do. I was incapable of doing what I was supposed to do. I went through the motions, and my conscience told me as long as I would go to work 5 or 6 days a week, that everything was going to be okay. Well, the reality was that this particular girl had some issues with addiction, just like I did. And by the time I was 25, she made a decision to end the relationship. She moved to Colorado, and I was the proud father of 2 children, a 6-year-old son and a 4-year-old daughter. Living in Fresno, going through the reflection of what went wrong, never owning up to or acknowledging or identifying that drinking was a part of the problem. Never being able to see the connection between my irresponsibility as a husband, irresponsibility as a worker, irresponsibility as a father, irresponsibility as any aspect of my life at that time. All I knew was that everybody my age was in the bars on Friday and Saturday night, and why couldn't I? I mean, that's the selfishness, self-centeredness of the disease of alcoholism that I didn't even understand. I did not have a clue that alcohol had had such a control of my life. By the time I was 30 years old, my children were in the care of a full-time nanny that was at my house at 6 in the morning until 6 at night so that I could go to work and to drink the way I drank. I ended up being confronted by a coworker who suggested that I have a discussion with a brother because I had a serious alcohol and drug problem. And the big book talks about a moment of clarity. And I think I knew, down deep inside, I knew that things weren't right. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. The hangovers were becoming unbearable. My physical health was starting to be obvious. Both my father and my mother had had several heart-to-heart discussions with me about the concerns of my children, their grandchildren. The denial and my ability to deny the impact that alcohol was having on me and my children finally started to surface. And when this particular colleague of mine suggested that I needed help, I had about a 30-second stop, and I said, okay. And within 24 hours, I admitted myself into a treatment facility in Fresno. And I went in on November 29th, 1988. And I went into that treatment facility naive and totally ignorant of the disease of alcoholism, of the disease of drug addiction, of Narcotics Anonymous, of Alcoholics Anonymous, of any anonymous. All I know is that when I walked into this treatment facility, my therapist sat me down and he asked me two questions. He said, how do you feel? And I could not understand the intention of that question. He said, how do you feel? And I said, I feel okay. And when I thought about what his question was, I could only have two points of reference, because the only feelings that I had experienced for the last couple of years was either fear of pain, or pain and fear, or being okay. And what he did was he revealed to me one of those wall calendars that has the 50 or 60 different faces on it, smiley faces, and under each one of those faces was the description of an emotion like exuberant, joyful, happy, sullen, all the different emotions. And I could not recall the last time that I could identify with 95% of the emotions that he had indicated to me. The second question that he asked me was, can you describe to me your understanding of spirituality? And I thought for a minute, and I said, I was an altar boy. I was an altar boy. And he said, yeah, I didn't ask you about your religious beliefs. I asked you, what is your understanding of spirituality? And I did not understand what he was trying to say. And from those questions, and from a willingness to do something different over the next 29 days, I learned about the disease of alcoholism and the disease of addiction. And I learned about Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous. And one of the things that I think about today is I remember walking into that treatment facility and that question that the therapist asked me. And the question was, what is your drug of choice? And I thought, well, I don't know how to answer that. Because I came into this facility, a trash can, looking for anything that would change the way I felt. And I often took what was readily available and offered from anybody that I thought would provide me the relief I sought. And in that facility, what I didn't know then that I learned today was that that answer to that question of my drug of choice dictated a decision that was made on my behalf as to whether I was an alcoholic or an addict. And that's always been the proverbial question that I've always wrestled with. Because I know that when having been in Alcoholics Anonymous and having been sent to Narcotics Anonymous, that I often had a difficult time trying to identify or feel where I fit. When I first got involved in Alcoholics Anonymous and the other program, I was focused on the differences, like a lot of us do. What I came to understand was that it didn't matter for me what my problem was. What I had to come to terms with was that I was in free flight of reality, that I was the kind of person that sought out something to change the way I feel. Now that I've been around for a while, I've had the opportunity to ultimately feel comfortable within Alcoholics Anonymous. I took my last drink and drug on November 29th of 1988, and I stayed sober until 2004, 17 years. During the course of 17 years, I remarried, had two more children, had the opportunity to start a business of my own, and got into a situation where I had to start making some difficult decisions. One of the decisions was, do I spend more time trying to build this business that I've gone out and taken this financially responsibility for, or do I stay actively involved in Alcoholics Anonymous? So what I started to do was, before, I was talking with a sponsor about once every week, and I was going to two or three meetings a week. And over the course of from about 1997 to about 2003, that went to seeing a sponsor about once a week to once a month to whenever I ran into him in Costco. And my meetings dropped off to three a week, to two a week, to one a week, to one a month, to maybe going to one or two conferences once or twice a year. What I know for me, what my experience is that when I'm not actively involved in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, when I'm not actively praying to God on a daily basis, what happens is my thinking starts to revert back to, I may not have this severe problem that I do with alcohol. And what happened to me after not staying connected in the fellowship, not being responsible to a sponsor in terms of honestly communicating to him where I was at and what was occurring in my life, I had a 14-year-old son that I had confiscated some marijuana from. And that marijuana I put in my nightstand. And that marijuana sat in that nightstand for about 6 months. And one Saturday, when I got pissed off over something that was unimportant, and I was home alone, I took the marijuana out and I smoked it. After smoking that marijuana, it wasn't long before I thought I could have a drink of wine. And I took a drink of wine. And the sky didn't fall down, the earth didn't shatter, nothing happened. Within the next couple of weeks, as I continued to re-explore whether or not I had an alcohol problem, something happened. The obsession returned. And now it wasn't just smoking some marijuana. It wasn't going and having a glass of wine. It was walking down to the liquor store and getting a fifth of Crown Royal and putting it in my car and saying to myself upon immediately awakening in the morning, gee, a pretty good draw off that bottle right now would be a good way to start my day. And that's what I did. And it wasn't long before my consumption of alcohol had returned to exactly where it was 17 years before. During that period of time, things were changing in my life. That second wife that I had married and had two more children with, she and I grew apart, for lack of a better word. And the marriage was becoming not only unhealthy, but it was done. The business that I had worked so hard to develop had resulted in me going through some changes that resulted in me having to buy out a partner, go through a freeze. It was an agricultural business too. And the end result was that I had to close that business. And I had to also enter into a divorce. And, you know, all of that and drinking the way I did took me to a point to where I didn't want to live anymore. And yet I still had that recall of Alcoholics Anonymous. I still remembered that there was a different way. And I came back to the Alano Club, walked into it. I didn't know anybody. Went to a 7 o'clock meeting, asked somebody for a phone number, left that meeting, drove away, gave them a call. They suggested I came back, and through the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been able to stay sober again. What I know today is that in order for me to be comfortable in my own skin, in order for me to enjoy the things that are important to me, I have to stay connected to Alcoholics Anonymous. To me, often the difference between a good day and a bad day is whether or not I pray the day I get up. You know, when I get up and I say two or three prayers to a God that I've come to understand while I'm in the shower, that typically sets me in a mindset to where I need to be. I find out that when I'm able to attend two or three meetings a week, stay connected with people in the fellowship, that those things that tend to cause me discomfort don't have the same effect on me as they do when I'm not around. It's important for me to stay connected with my sponsor or people that I have come to trust. And it's important for me to stay connected to those people and let them know what's going on in my life and to also ask them what's going on in their life. You know, what I find out the longer I hang around Alcoholics Anonymous is that I don't always have to be the one that is seeking answers. I don't always have to be the one that's dumping the problems. What I find out today is that sometimes it's just as good for me to listen and to be available to someone else in the fellowship to listen to what's going on in their life. And those are the things that I've come to learn today. And through the grace of God, fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps, sponsorship, and a God that I've come to understand and have faith in, my life's a lot better today. So with that, I'll end, and I'm Tom, and I'm still an alcoholic. Thank you.
Can you think of any questions you guys might have for Tom? One thing I'm curious, one of the biggest things that people have, or I had an issue with, is picking a sponsor.
Yeah.
How did you do that?
I've had four sponsors in 23 years. And in each case, what I typically did was go to a meeting, listen to different people share, and try to seek out somebody that demonstrated to me an understanding and a fundamental knowledge of the Big Book. You know, an understanding and a fundamental knowledge of the Big Book. Somebody that had an understanding of how to establish that conscious contact with a higher power. For me, the problem that I always have wrestled with in my sobriety was step three, because I am an intellectual. I have the ability to rationalize and justify and develop a option through just about anything I want to do. And it's very important for me to be able to understand my role in sobriety and the role of my higher power. You know, my God gave me the ability to do a lot of things. He did not give me the ability to be God. And sometimes in my sense of urgency or my sense of trying to be effective at what I do, I step out of being Tom and I step into playing God. And I need to be aware of that. And I needed to find in all my sponsors that were able to identify to me when I'm outside of my comfort zone and when I need to understand what my role is and what God's role is.
How were you able to meet people and talk to people so that you could build a group of friends?
I mean, probably the and that's one of the things that I wrestle with, because I hear in meetings about the importance of seeking out the winners. And I understand for me what that means. I thought at first it meant seek out the people that are popular. What I've come to understand is for me, I seek out people that I believe have the same level of commitment about their recovery that I do, and also people that have some of the same goals in their life that I do. You know, I try to look for people that want the same things out of life that I do. You know, and that's what I try to do.
I like your Emma retreat, and I just want to know how hard it was for you to walk back in that door the next time, and what got you to do that and to stay, because that was the hardest thing for me, and yet when I got back, your reaction was wonderful.
The question was, how hard was it for me to walk back into that door, and what was the driving factor that did it? I am a coward by nature, and I don't want you to know that. And in the back of my mind, I had a handgun that I was thinking about as a viable option to ending my life. I didn't possess the macho or the courage to actually get the handgun and stick it under my chin, but it scared me that thought literally came into my mind, and it became a valid option. And when I drove away from that meeting thinking about what would be easier, going back to Alcoholics Anonymous and having to swallow some ego and some pride and admit to people that I drank after 17 years, or going and getting that handgun and blowing my brain off and leaving four children with no father during a divorce, the latter didn't sound very good. The latter didn't sound very good. And again, you know, it isn't because I have any virtue. I thank God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And once I admitted surrender, once I surrendered that was my only salvation, it became pretty easy. I mean, I'll be honest with you. When I came back to the Alarm Club and I sat at the counter, there were a couple of alcoholics in there that had talked with me for about an hour and a half. And by noon, all that shame and all that guilt and all that fear was gone. So it only took about, I mean, it took about an hour and 45 minutes for me to work through my own selfishness and ego to get back to being humble enough and willing enough to allow you and other people in the fellowship to comfort me and love me enough so that I could give myself a second chance. And by the noon meeting, by 1:30 in the afternoon, I was already starting to feel hope and joy. I knew that I had a tough road to hoe. I knew that there was going to be hell to pay over the next 18 months in sorting through all of the financial and marital and children issues that I had to walk through. But you know, there's something about sitting in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and listening to other people share about the same trials and tribulations. And all of a sudden, when I'm able to observe another person share about what I'm about to experience, and they're okay, all of a sudden, I'm okay. And that's a lot better place for me to be than sitting at home by myself thinking, attempting to think through that same gauntlet without other people and watching other people do it successfully. So, you know, that's, you know, again, I owe it to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I owe it to the fellowship, and I owe it to those people that welcomed me back and did not judge me for my past. Just basically said, come on in, there's a book, there's a coffee pot, here's a meeting schedule. You have 17 years, you know what to do. Get back on the horse, come on back. I mean, that's what it was for me. When I came back in, what was important for me and what I knew from experience was that I needed to get back into the steps. I needed to get back into the steps. I needed to get back into that four-step inventory and find out what specifically were the things that maybe had not been addressed the first time I worked my steps that had surfaced later on that may have been a catalyst to some of my shortcomings the second go around. You know, what I know today, I do the best job I can. You know. Thank you.
Thanks, sir.